So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety.
Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And David, I am glorying, by the way, in this fabulous spring weather.
Yes.
I don't know what the weather will be like when the listener who now is got this thing plugged in is, but here today, right now, as we speak,
yes,
it is approaching mid-April in Middle Tennessee.
And we're looking at 80s today.
Oh.
Yeah.
And once again, I am humbled by the realization that I am very much a slave to my environment. Well, perhaps not a slave, but heavily influenced by my environment.
Mm-hmm.
And a sunny day, I'm a different person.
Yeah. Well, a nice warm breeze and some sunshine and, fresh air and all of that.
Let's go to the beach.
Yeah. Let's just. We could do this from anywhere, right? Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the gifts of recovery is that our options do expand.
Yes.
Do you remember that from your years of active addiction, how life did get very, very repetitive?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, for me at least, it felt like my options kept diminishing.
Mm-hmm. In the active, when I was active in my addiction, my options kept diminishing because they would have risked bad consequences, and the consequences were getting bigger. So I just kept limiting my opportunity to experience them. You know,
it was, and I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I really do believe that my addiction was slowly assassinating my creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And
Well, here's what's funny. I don't know if you've ever had this experience in your type of addiction and acting out, but I believed for a time that my drinking enhanced my creativity, and I really did believe it. And I was working on a what I thought was a book at the time, mm-hmm. and it was an unpublished thing. And I fancied myself a fiction writer, and so I used to love to drink and write and drink and write and drink and write. And I'd get up the next day, and nothing made sense.
Oh yeah,
it was the biggest bunch of gibberish and disconnected thoughts and random. It was like somebody took the lid off the hamster cage and looked in. It was absolutely terrible. So to your point about creativity, when I was active in my addiction, my brain was pretty paralyzed. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm a sex addict, so I couldn't very well act out and write at the same time.
I have so many great lines that I can't say right now.
But it's nice. I can now type with both hands. It's awesome.
It has to do with being ambidextrous. It has all kinds of, oh, golly, man. Well, we've got to do another one of these where we put up a, an adult theme warning or something. I can respond like I want to that.
Yeah. But it is true. It really felt to me when I finally was given the gift of sobriety that it's almost as though my brain came online.
It did.
And my creativity, it felt like it just tripled.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I became willing to start to take some creative risks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're going to talk about today. We've got a great guest coming in.
We do, and it's a really unique type of therapy that we're going to explore today.
Okay. I hope that's enough of a tease to convince our listeners to stay with us. We'll be back. Stay close. We'll be back in a minute here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Well, welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and we have a fascinating guest today.
We do, indeed.
And I got to tell you, even before I even knew who he was, when I walked in the room, I just knew, this is a rock star. he's got it going on. I don't know where you shop for that cool look, but he's cool as hell.
Well, and sitting with us, you know, one of these is not like the other.
So I don't know.
Yeah,
whether
he's great.
Phil Bogart is with us. Thank you, Phil, for joining us.
Well, thank you so very much for having me.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, we're in a studio here at Crossroads of the Nations with our producer and engineer Rex. I mean, this is not an arena. You've been on stage in arenas a bit.
I have, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I've had three major label careers.
Okay.
The very first was a band that I formed with a childhood friend called Ingram Hill, signed a major label deal in 2003. We had a little bit of radio success, some placements in a few major motion pictures, a few placements in network TV shows. We did Jimmy Kimmel Live, a lot of regional morning shows. We did the National Fox Morning News show at the time, and bounced around with the likes of Maroon 5 and Jason Mraz, as well as a bunch of the late 90s acts like Collective Soul and Live and Tonic, Sister Hazel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And but that was like your first career as a major
label. That was the
label.
first go around. Then, like a lot of musicians, I ended up moving to Nashville, and unlike a lot of musicians, I landed a hip hop gig instead of a country gig.
Really? Wow.
Absolutely. So I ran around with a trap artist named Jelly Roll, who is from Antioch. He's from South Nashville.
Yeah.
Straight out the trap. but he's a legit trap star, and it has been incredibly useful tool with my new line of work, which we'll get into momentarily. But yeah, I ran around the country with Jelly Roll, playing with Cypress Hill, Insane Clown Posse, Yellow Wolf.
They're all. I mean, they feature They really feature on my mixtapes.
Absolutely.
Are there mixtapes anymore? There aren't mixtapes
I don't think
anymore.
So. No. I think we just dated you.
Yeah.
No, they actually still use, in that realm, they still use the term mixtape. They're not
really?
They're not literally on a cassette tape. They're playlist online, basically, but they still call them mixtapes, and they still drop mixtapes all the time. There is a difference between dropping a mixtape and dropping an album.
Wow.
Okay.
So
good.
See? We're learning.
You're
more.
Relevant. You're on top of it.
You just got relevant again.
You are current. You are current in the hip hop realm of the United States today.
All right, then hook me up with Jelly Roll.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. And does the story end there? Or did you wind up on stage again?
Story does not end there. So from there, I got yanked away by a duo, a country duo called Walker McGuire. That was a Broken Bow act, and they had a hit single. Probably about 18 months ago, called Till Tomorrow, that cracked the top 40 in country radio. And with them, I toured arenas with Kane Brown, Lee Bryce, Jake Owen, Gary Allen.
Big names, yeah.
Yeah. So,
and today, you are the Nashville Program Administrator for Rock to Recovery.
That is correct.
Well, how did the leap happen?
Well, it's an interesting story. I'm glad you asked. the quickest version of the story is I was bouncing down the road, sleeping in a bunk, playing arenas for a living, playing the big festivals, and then the clubs and the in-between, just grinding it out. I was living the dream. I was living that thing that everybody is coming to this town to do for the most part.
Yeah.
And it was everything that I ever wanted it to be until the exact moment that it wasn't. And I can't tell you, you know, what it was that changed. I just know that something inside me was looking for something bigger, something deeper, a more of a spiritual existence. And I didn't know where that would land me. And I started reaching all over the place. But there's an organization that is the charitable arm of the Grammys called mm-hmm. Music Cares.
Right.
And I've had a longstanding friendship with them. They've helped me get friends into treatment that were struggling with addiction or alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just formed a friendship with them. And I was on the phone with Erica out in the LA office. I was looking at possibly going to LA and writing, being a staff writer, writing sure. Music for reality TV shows. And I was just looking all over the place for what the next thing in life would be. I had no idea where I was headed. Mm-hmm. I just knew that I was looking for something. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have that pull, that, yeah. that thing inside. And, yeah, just having this conversation with Erica and you know, I guess a midlife crisis. I think I'm at that age that it's okay to say a midlife crisis. And I, you know, in this freak out, you know, asking what I should be doing with my life. So, oh, there's this company, and I don't know what it's called, but it is the guy from Korn. It's a guy from Korn, and he has a company. That's all I know. And she said, are you talking about Rock to Recovery? And I said, I think so. I think that's what I'm talking about. She said, well, turns out I'm on the board of directors. To which nice. I replied, well, can you introduce me to that guy? And she said, I just hit send on the email. Take it easy.
Now, did you have a recovery story of your own
Absolutely.
Prior to this point?
Absolutely. So at the moment that I was on the phone with her, I was closing in on 10 years clean and sober.
Wow.
And, you know, and that may play into kind of the lead up and everything that I was saying there of feeling that spiritual pull towards something. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. There was a milestone coming.
Yeah.
You were ready for some 12th step work.
I was ready for something.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, back up a little bit, if you don't mind. We love to hear just the personal stories of our guests. Tell us a little bit about childhood upbringing before you started the band, a little bit of that recovery story.
Most definitely. So, you know, my childhood was very very middle class. Mm-hmm. I was born in Jackson, Mississippi. Then I moved to Memphis when I was four. Age 11 through 17, I spent in York, Pennsylvania. Then to Jackson, Tennessee for ages 18 and 19, and then back to Memphis. And college age, 19. Is when Ingram Hill formed. You know, my childhood was great. Loving parents. My parents are still together. Younger sister who's extremely successful in her field. She has a PhD in biological research.
Wow.
I picked up the guitar at age 8, and there was never a different plan mm-hmm. from then on.
No plan B.
There was no plan B. There was a lot of arguments about D's on report cards. There was a lot of talks at the dinner table about avocation versus vocation. Music is an avocation, not a vocation. Mm-hmm. And so I spent the majority of my life trying to prove that music could be both an avocation and a vocation to my father.
Yeah.
But the thing that I did not know until it happened was that I actually suffered from stage fright.
Really?
I could actually get up there on stage to play and out of nowhere get smacked. Right mm-hmm. in the throat, right in the gut, right mm-hmm. in the knees, right in every part of the body, brain, and soul
yeah.
with crippling stage fright.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you knew this, but if you throw a little alcohol on there, sometimes that cures that stage fright, right?
I've heard that can happen.
Right, yeah. right. A couple beers, and all of a sudden I'm back to feeling like Keith Richards,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
And very rapidly, 2 turns to 4, 4 turns to 8. You know, and then you're embarrassed about what you did last night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? I had a solution to the icky feelings before, so why not pour a little more of that solution on these icky feelings?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it becomes very cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular world, I was living in a realm where that behavior is a little more overlooked than the rest of
really
than yeah. most occupations.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It is cliche. And to some degree, it's less tolerated, I think, than the majority of people would think, especially in this day and age, you
right.
know,
mm-hmm.
coming out of the 90s, especially when so many of, you know, highly successful acts. I mean, look at how many of those guys are gone now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. sure. Yeah.
And people just, it hurts.
Yeah,
it
absolutely.
Hurts to be a part of that. It hurts to watch someone, you know, create their own demise.
Yeah.
Right.
However, it is still way more tolerated than had I been working in a law office or a bank or, you
right,
know,
yeah.
any job,
yeah.
any other, you know, job. So, yeah, I got to a place with my drinking, my liquid courage, my social lubricant, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. It became the solution to all things. It became right. the solution to taking the trash to the end of the street.
Yeah.
In case I bumped into a neighbor and had to talk and didn't mm-hmm. want to be seen shaking.
Mm-hmm.
It became my solution for every single thing.
Yeah.
And then there was one day that I started off my day like I would, like any responsible adult does, with a 12-pack of beer for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Responsible adults don't do that. That was a joke. But I started my day with a 12-pack of beer for breakfast, and I went probably 10 or 12 hours without taking a drink after that, and woke up on the wrong side of a police officer's flashlight, unable to answer questions to which I should know the answer, like, what's your middle name? Yeah. What year is it? Mm-hmm. Who's the president of the United States?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was I had just had my very first full-blown seizure from delirium tremens. I wow. just had my first full-blown withdrawal seizure.
DTs.
Wow.
DTs.
Yeah.
And, you know, my brain was rebooting like an old Packard Bell computer. If you didn't shut it down correctly, mm-hmm. if you just yank the cord out of the wall mm-hmm. and you turn it back on, and it grinds and makes all those awful noises. that was what the brain and body was doing.
Yeah.
Mm. So wow. That was kind of the beginning of it coming to a head. That was not the end of my drinking. That was mm-hmm. the beginning of a whole new phase of drinking, of mm-hmm. living to stay ahead of that,
right.
drinking to stay ahead of that occurrence.
Mm-hmm. At that point, then, drinking to manage the addiction, to manage the drinking, and really no big payoffs anymore.
No. There's not even the relaxing exhale moment of, oh, this drink feels good. At
mm-hmm.
that point,
mm-hmm.
it is either a state of withdrawal, violent shaking, or y'all gonna have to help carry me to walk across the room.
Mm-hmm.
There's no in between. There is withdrawal and I can't walk anymore.
Yeah. Did you have bandmates or friends that were coming to you and going, Phil, you know, you might want to knock it back just a
100%, 100%. You know, over the years, plenty of people tried to reel it back in, and everybody, mm-hmm. you know, there's a term that we use, frothy emotional appeal.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and that was the case, and you know, everyone wanted to be understanding. Everyone wanted to help, and
mm-hmm.
You know. And be soft about it. And that was
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the time.
Yeah.
They were doing the best they could. It's my thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to mm-hmm. be held accountable for
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I had plenty of loving people trying to help all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you know, with addiction, with alcoholism, with these things, it kind of, the right moment has to land at the right time under the right circumstances
mm-hmm.
with the right, you know,
yeah.
everything.
Yeah. What was, if you don't mind, what was your kind of final wall that you hit that was like, because sometimes it's not a wall, you know, sometimes it's just a whimper. It's
well,
just,
no. Mine was definitely, you know, some explosive moments, but I spent a few months after that first delirium tremens bout, I spent the next few months drinking around the clock. I spent the next few months in my mind still feel like a whole year of drinking, when it was really only about 3 or 4 more months that
mm-hmm.
I was drinking. But at that point, I was no longer having a day.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't wake up, have a day, and go to bed
right.
and have another day.
Mm-hmm.
I woke up and drank till I passed out, and then I woke up and drank till I passed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I could do that 3 times in a day.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you if it was 7 o'clock and the sun was, you know, in that
mm-hmm.
weird, I didn't know if it was morning or night. I would
mm-hmm.
ask somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the accountability to which I was held by a lot of folks, again, and it's all on me. I don't ever put anything on anybody else, but the
mm-hmm.
accountability to which I was held by other folks was very directly proportionate to the success
right.
of my musical career
mm-hmm.
during a lot of that, where when things were way on the up and up, everybody kind of was way more willing to look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And when things were on the downslide is when people sit you down and say, man, you drank way too much. You know that?
yeah.
But here at this end moment in that last phase, it had all come crumbling down.
Yeah.
Like anybody that I thought I had kept this secret from, it was no longer a secret.
Mm-hmm.
The family knew. I was having fallout with every person in my life. Yeah. It was all around me. It was inevitable. And the final moment was when the lead singer of that band, Ingram Hill, Justin, showed up at my house. And I speak about this a lot because it was this pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. And he didn't come at me the way I thought he was about to come at me. I saw where this was headed. I mm-hmm. saw what was about to happen, and I played it out in my head. And he threw a curveball at me. He didn't say, "You're messing up my business. You're hurting this thing that we've built. You're, you know." Mm-hmm. It was, man, like, screw you. This isn't fair. Mm-hmm. I would never walk into your living room and kill myself in front of you mm-hmm. because I love you mm-hmm. and you're my brother. Mm-hmm. So why on earth would you expect me to watch you kill yourself? Mm-hmm. That's wow. not fair. And if this is what you have to do, if there's no talking you out of this, you got to go somewhere else and not do it in front of me. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what you owe me. Mm-hmm. You don't owe me anything but that. The only thing you owe me is to not kill yourself right in front of my eyes.
Wow.
You know, and it was the perfect moment, the perfect collision, the perfect mm-hmm. storm mm-hmm. where I picked up the telephone and said, "I need help."
Yeah.
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 Man.
So I presume then you went to treatment, you got some help detoxing.
I did. So my parents lived in Jackson, Tennessee. They still do. And I called my parents and went and saw a family physician in Jackson. They recommended I go to Cumberland Heights up here in Nashville. I was living in Memphis at the time. They wanted me out of town.
Right.
You know, so I came. I gained 28 pounds in 28 days. On the Cumberland Heights famous prime rib,
yeah.
biscuits and gravy meal plan. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I spent 28 days out there in the, yeah. on River Road.
Wow. So, and then miraculously, kind of the music comes back. Life gets a little bit better.
It does. It does. It comes and goes in waves, you know.
Yeah.
So, it definitely, the first year is, man. It is that first year.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
The first year is awesome and terrible and scary and mm-hmm. great and awful and everything in between, yeah. you know. But there is such a beauty and simplicity in that very first year because, you know, when the bottom drops out, when it gets the scariest and the worst, mm-hmm. and you go to bed and you didn't take a drink, you're the king of the world. Mm-hmm. You right. have won.
Yeah.
You know, and I try all the time to find that simplicity.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I try all the time to get back to that thought mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, you know, it really still is a miracle. It really still is a victory every single day that you hit the pillow without mm-hmm. taking a drink or using a drug.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And so you feel you come out of Cumberland Heights, you're getting, did you go right back into the road world, or
they were on tour? I was given the option. They said, I think they had like maybe another month long run.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was either two to 4 weeks that they were still out. I was given the option, and I said, you know what? Like, let me get on some firm ground mm-hmm. here.
Yeah, smart.
Absolutely. Yeah. The guy that had been our guitar tech for years was filling in for me. I let him finish out that tour.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to kind of work on me for a minute. However, I did go back pretty quickly. I think I was 60 days sober when I hit the next tour, and we were gone for like a six-week run.
Wow.
We did a full run of the U.S., worked our way across the south of the U.S., all the way up to hit California, and then all the way up through to Seattle and back around.
Mm-hmm.
So I was definitely very, very brand new.
Yeah,
bouncing down the road at it again.
Well, and so you're in sobriety. You're beginning to realize you're living from a different set of, you know, I mean, it's about everything, right? It, you know, beliefs, values, things you thought you knew that you no longer really know at all, and just a lot of resets, right?
100%.
For me, speaking for myself, a lot of resets. And so when you get back into music and you're doing this again and you're getting, quote, your life back, then at what point was the shine wearing off of that you end up on the phone with Erica and saying, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself?
Oh, that was like a decade later. So,
yeah.
I mean, there was so much chasing, so much succeeding, so much failing,
mm-hmm.
and everything in between in those 10 years. Mm-hmm. In those 10 years, I mean, the amount of time I spent in the studio was unreal. I hadn't done the math until right this very moment I'm trying to put it together, but a ton of recording. I did 5 albums with Jelly Roll in a very short amount of time. I think I did Sober. I think I did 2 or 3 albums with Ingram Hill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the amount of writing music that I did, even when I was still living in Memphis, I was driving to Nashville once a week,
mm-hmm.
And spending a couple days doing songwriting sessions on a Music Row,
mm-hmm.
Bouncing down the road playing all these shows. It wasn't until I was coming up on that 10-year mark that, and there was plenty of other outside factors as well.
Sure.
You know, it seriously is just getting harder and harder to make a decent living playing music.
Mm-hmm.
It's as the world of technology keeps growing.
Yeah.
You know, the a major record label is still spending the same amount of money that they would have. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago to create a star, to make mm-hmm. someone famous, to mm-hmm. keep them relevant once they are famous.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have CD sales anymore to get the return on that investment.
Physical product is
yes.
gone.
So the record labels are taking a piece of ticket sales, T-shirt sales,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, especially like in the country world, that's traditionally where the band gets paid.
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just, you know, so many factors. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was in a panic, knowing some people that were at the top of the list, people playing for the A-listers that still had to have side jobs
mm-hmm.
To make ends meet.
Yeah.
Now, had you ever seen the magic of this amateur writing session, this thing that Rock to Recovery does? Had you ever seen it before you made that phone call?
Never.
All right. First of all, describe to our listeners what you guys freaking do.
It's pretty crazy. So,
yeah.
And I didn't know until I showed up to my very first training session. Like, they even tried to explain it over the phone, and it's one of those things. It's hard to visualize, but I'll try to paint a good picture for you. Basically, we go into these treatment centers. We work with VA hospitals. We work with mental health facilities, kind of anywhere in the healing space, but it definitely got launched in the drug and alcohol treatment world. We go in. We get non-musicians playing basic skills on piano, percussion instruments, guitars. We get people who have been told all their lives that they can't sing to sing,
mm-hmm.
and we write and record an original song in every single session. Yeah. And then it goes up on the SoundCloud forever. It is there for them to listen to.
Wow. And you're a nonprofit.
Well, we have two arms. We work in both
okay.
spaces.
Okay. And so you're going into treatment centers. And so, I can imagine, the newly sober person, you know, getting handed an egg shaker or a tambourine or a guitar or whatever, and thinking, you know, what the hell are you asking me to do? I mean, today I could barely, you know, think, function. Getting up was a thing, and you're asking me to use the front part of my brain to be creative. How do you, not persuade, maybe, but how do you invite this in a way that makes someone engage that?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Very specifically, so one of the nonprofits with whom I work is Buffalo Valley, and I work at their detox, Alan mm-hmm. Dickerson, mm-hmm. and that is you know, a for real detox
yeah.
scenario that I'm stepping into,
mm-hmm.
and you've got some guys that I'm walking in early on a Tuesday morning. You've got some guys coming off heroin, detox from heroin. That haven't slept. They've been trying to sleep for, you know, 72 hours. They just fell asleep 2 hours ago, and now someone woke them up and said, hey, there's a guy out there with long hair. You're going to play music with him. And they're like, well, I'll hit him. How's that? How about that? We'll do that instead.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll just knock him in the face,
uh-huh.
and we can call it a day. Is that
yeah.
cool? But, you know, when we were starting, I told you that my work with Jelly Roll has mm-hmm. been like this tool that is outrageously, incredibly effective in that particular environment. When they find out that I'm the guy in the video to one of their favorite songs,
yeah. mm-hmm.
or that I helped write that song, or that I'm the one playing guitar on that song they've heard, the stuff that I've done in that hip-hop realm is huge.
Oh.
More than one time, I have gone into one of those sessions And one of these guys in there has lyrics tattooed on their body.
Oh, really?
Wow. Of a song that I am playing on.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, yeah.
On that album, a song that I am in the video for.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a game changer. As soon as they realize that's me,
yeah,
they're on board.
Yeah,
yeah.
They are on board.
Sudden credibility and
absolutely
respect.
Absolutely.
I am. I'm fascinated by the emotional and psychological and neurological mechanics
absolutely.
Of what you're doing as an aid to recovery. What's going on in the brain, and why, apparently, if you're getting such wide acceptance within the treatment world, there is something demonstrably effective about this therapeutic approach. Tell us about that, and what do you think the mechanics are?
Well, so we actually, Dr. Constance Scharf is on our board, and she is the chair of scientific research. Mm-hmm. And she can speak really well in terms of the technical terms, the beautiful terms.
Okay, we need to book her for another episode.
100%, 100%, 100%. So I'll speak to it from more of the layman.
All right.
Regarding neuroscience.
Okay.
But we're definitely considered a wraparound therapy. Now, you were talking about using the front part of the brain. Actually, when you play music, when you actively participate, when you sing, it's one of the few activities that fires off both halves of the brain. It releases oxytocin and increases serotonin and dopamine levels. And the moral of the story is that it literally gets you high. Mm-hmm. When you sing, when you play, you get high.
More than when you listen to music.
100%, absolutely. When you listen to music, you fire off one half of your brain. So that's kind of my sales pitch. As I'm in there, as I'm in there pitching a session to, mm-hmm. to new people, I talk about, you know, everyone knows that music is therapeutic by nature. Everyone has a song that's gone through a hard time in their life. Everyone has a song that has that power of euphoric recall. You know, every time I hear Bryan Adams, I go straight back to Couple Skate Only in fourth grade. You know what I mean? But when you're listening, you're firing off one half of your brain.
Right.
Actively participating, singing, especially singing. So one of the patented things that we do, I patented the term. I'll take credit for it. It's called the gang sang. So it's important that we have a chorus that everybody can sing along to. We want everybody singing. That's mm-hmm. that's where you really get the chemicals cooking in the pharmacy and the noggin
right.
that gets people high.
Right.
You know, and part of that sales pitch is, I don't know about y'all, but there was a lot of traffic in my way getting from home to here
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot of people moving here every single day.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. they are moving here to play music.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
because playing music gets you high. It really is a natural high.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as the therapeutic value, you know, it's very much a wraparound therapy. They do take notice. They mm-hmm. is the other clinicians, the folks that work in these facilities notice that what we do helps the other therapy take hold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not how the brain works. 100% this is not how the brain works, but it's a great metaphor. It's almost like if the brain is this tense muscle and they're trying to penetrate with therapy totally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the guy that comes in and massages the brain.
Okay.
You know mm-hmm. what I mean? I get you to let go for a minute. We relax. We have fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
We get the chemicals cooking. We get naturally high. We get out of our comfort zone a little bit in order to get some big relief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, once again, about you've done all those shows with Jelly Roll. What little I know about hip hop shows is that there is kind of this antiphonal call and response thing, or the artist talks a lot to the crowd, and the crowd talks back, and then it's participatory a lot, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And did you pick up that? Did you learn that energy in hip hop, and then you bring that to the room? How do you get guys motivated to?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I've been around too many Presbyterians.
Well, it is a plate spinning act. It is a plate spinning act for sure. And Wes, my boss, the founder of the company, he kind of jokes that it's part motivational speaker, it's part game show host, it's part musician, it's part producer,
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, part band leader. It is all these things that you're doing all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a lot of positive reinforcement. Some days are harder than others. There are some days where it's everything I can do to get folks to participate. One of my big sales pitches on the whole thing, though, is all the times in my journey in sobriety that someone got me to step out of my comfort zone and the relief that I got.
Yeah.
Right? Like little incremental things like, hey, we're going to go grab a cup of coffee at Starbucks and talk about this. To which I respond, no, we are not. That sounds awful. And, you know, and then this person talks me into doing it and I feel better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? 15 minutes of honesty and I feel better. And all those times that, you know, whether it was doing a personal inventory in recovery, whether it was going and squaring up the past with people, mm-hmm. like all these things that are very not comfortable, you know, very much stepping out of the comfort zone bring such great relief.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm doing is like the kindergarten version of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm at the simplest level, I'm getting you to come out and step out of the comfort zone.
Yeah.
Briefly.
Yeah.
And look at how much relief you get.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, again, the proof is in the pudding. Like, once you get them to participate, it's happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Once you got them, you got them.
Yeah.
They don't walk away.
So you're in a room with these folks. How many people would you include at a time in a group? What would a group look like?
A group is anywhere from 2 to 15, typically.
Okay.
I've done bigger groups. The biggest groups I've done was with, so we have a contract with the Department of Defense to do the Air Force Wounded Warrior Program. And so I've done some really big groups with them,
mm-hmm.
where you're working with the warriors and the caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
But in a typical day-to-day setting, again, anywhere from 2 to 15 is about
par for the course. As a songwriter, how do you guide them along the theme of the song, like the subject of the material?
Well, we start every session with a check-in, like a clinical check-in, where we have a question. Sometimes, you know, you have to feed on the mood.
Right.
But a lot of times you try to dig pretty deep with a check-in question.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, what is something, you know, in the healing space, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the healing space, whether it's in treatment, whether it's in any kind of self-evaluation, it's always kind of like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? Today, here's my check-in question. What's right with me?
Mm.
What's right today?
Mm-hmm.
What's something good I can say about myself today?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Another check-in question that I've been using recently is, what is something that, you know, coming here you thought would be awful, something that you thought was going to be bad, something you thought would suck that actually doesn't,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Again, with me, it's the inventory process.
Mm-hmm.
I thought when I learned about the inventory process in sobriety, I'm like, well, that's terrible. That is not fun. I'm not going to like this. It's one of my favorite tools I have at my disposal.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, and same
my first instinct was just to list liabilities, and that's only half of an inventory,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. So we start down that road. However, one of my favorite things, if you go down my playlist, each one of the program administrators has their own playlist. That's how the clients find their songs.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many songs that the first line of the song is, I don't know what you want me to say. How am I supposed to know what to say? Stuff like that, because mm-hmm. I tell them, I say, give me the first line of the song, and whatever they say is what I write down.
Uh-huh.
And I show them that is the first line of a song.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
The thought that you're having right now is the first line of your song.
Yeah.
You know? So there, I've got dozens that say, I don't know what you want me to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the greatest first line. It's my favorite first line of a song.
Yeah.
Because it shows them, I fire back with a rhyme on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a Jedi mind trick. You know, you start speaking to somebody in iambic pentameter, they'll start
mm-hmm.
speaking back.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, they're speaking back to you rhythmically,
mm-hmm.
unaware.
Yeah.
And I'm just jotting down, showing them, no, you are writing lyrics, you
yeah.
know. My grandmother, for example, is a person of a different generation, clearly,
mm-hmm.
that her and her sisters had a method by which they knew where everything in their house got put up. She had seven sisters, so that's eight girls in one house, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think they knew where everything went? They sang songs. They wrote little songs that told them where everything in the house went, right?
Wow.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
None of these ladies was going to be an operatic singer.
Uh-huh.
None of these ladies was going to go stand on a stage and be, you know, famous for singing.
Mm-hmm.
But that particular generation, nobody ever would have told those girls, hey, y'all can't carry a tune.
Mm-hmm.
Y'all can't sing. Y'all don't have rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that notion didn't exist.
Uh-huh.
That notion in the history of mankind is brand spanking new, is only a couple generations old. Music has belonged to all people forever. Until recently.
You think that's because once music began to be consumed by the masses and we had...
Got monetized.
Yeah,
got monetized.
A means by which we measured good, you know? Well, it's good because it's on this show, or it's good because it's made this much money, or it's good because
it's on the countdown this week.
This much, yeah, this many CDs.
Somewhere along those lines of pop culture,
yeah.
you know, it became... reserved for the top 1%, if you
mm-hmm.
will. you know?
Yeah, the commodity.
Where music just used to belong to everybody. Everybody used to sing.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest hurdle I have to get over is people saying, no, you don't want me to sing.
Mm-hmm.
No, yes, I do. 100%.
But it's even kind of like church. There was a point in time where everybody would sing in church because it didn't matter. And now you feel like you have to be a trained professional for people to go to church.
Yeah.
I've heard. But yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, but the same thing is happening. It's participatory.
Absolutely.
You know? So how long does a session take? You've got these people in a room, you've got a subject, and you've got the antiphonal back and forth going. And so how long is a session?
Our standard session is 90 minutes.
Okay.
So it's fast-paced, it's moving, it is jamming.
Yeah.
From the get-go.
So if I want to experience one of these sessions, is my only option to go to treatment?
That's a good question. We can discuss,
or go to war,
or go to war. Yeah. No, I'm so wondering, we do. This is such a valuable tool, it seems to me, in recovery. I do know a huge part of recovery, as you have already said so well, is stepping out, doing something new, taking a risk. Our addictive behavior is so ritualistic and so cyclical, and we get stuck in these tiny rooms, and that defines everything about us.
Mm-hmm.
Now in recovery, we're pushed to do new things. And here we've got something that's deep in our DNA. It's part of our cultural heritage. There's a song in us, whether we know it or not. And now you guys have found a way to kind of open that door and let that genie out again. How many people can benefit from that?
Oh, and that, so we do kind of team meditations when we do, you know, like our business meetings, our quarterly business meetings,
uh-huh.
and we do group meditation. And that is the thing, we're always looking for where else does this fit? Who else can benefit from what we're doing?
Yeah.
Because the more that this has been done, the more it's been realized, oh, there's this whole group over here that benefits from this.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, again, it was born out of, you know, the drug and alcohol treatment realm. But, I mean, we have a guy in Southern California working with spinal cord injuries with the VA hospital.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that'll hit you right in the throat.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So we're always trying to figure out, you know, who else benefits from this?
Yeah.
Where else can we carry this?
Yeah.
Who else can hear this message? Because it's not just exclusive to recovery from addiction.
Mm-hmm.
It is universal.
And you were saying earlier, Phil, the amount of sessions that collectively that Rock to Recovery does, you're over the Nashville branch.
Yes.
But then there's the LA. How many chapters or branches of this around are there?
Well, so program administrators, I believe there's 13 right now.
Mm-hmm.
Most are in Southern California. We have one guy in the Bay Area in California. We have a guy in Portland, and then me in Nashville.
Okay.
And so we're in over 100 facilities, and we're doing over 400 sessions a month.
Wow. And if I wanted my facility in Nashville to know about you, or which most of them may probably do, but you know, how do we get in touch with you?
RockToRecovery.org.
Okay. RockToRecovery.org. That's easy.
That's easy.
You're easy
That's
to find.
Easy. I'm very easy to track down.
So what's the reaction? So you get the song. You get the song done, you know, or as done as a song gets.
Absolutely.
You know? And what's the reaction of people that have participated in this after, you know, a bad night of Suboxone and, you know, feeling like crap?
Absolutely. So, you know, and we work in detox, we work in inpatient, we work with IOP, I work with MAT programs, mm-hmm. again, with veterans. You know, more often than not, especially inpatients, like my favorite reaction
mm-hmm.
is I was leaving today. I was about to walk out the door. I'd had it with all this. I was done with it, and now mm-hmm. I'm going to stay.
Mm-hmm. Going AMA and out.
I was about to leave, and now I'm going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, holy mackerel, I feel so much better. I don't know what you did. I don't know how you did it, but I'm going to stay.
Wow.
That's my favorite, and I get that more often than you would probably believe.
Wow.
Well, Phil, we are, I'm speaking for David, but I'm doing with great confidence, I know. We're just so glad that we were introduced
absolutely.
To you. Yeah. Thank you, John Weber, for making that hookup.
Yeah, absolutely.
So glad that you braved the traffic. You fought
the good fight.
To get all the way down here. right. And I really look forward to learning more about Rock to Recovery. And I don't know, maybe I'll go into treatment or something.
So I did want to answer. I did want to answer that realistically. So we do press events. We do experiential booths at different events. I know Foundations has an event in June that my boss Wes will come and speak, and we usually do kind of like a briefer version, but an experiential version for everyone in attendance. Mm-hmm. So we are out and about. And I will make sure you are at the top of the invite list next time I do something publicly that is an experiential version.
Thank you.
Nate plays a mean shaker. And even if he doesn't, he's got a home, right?
Absolutely. He will be gang singing and beating on a drum before he knows it.
That's awesome. I'm going.
All right. Well, what a great conversation we've had with Phil Bogard of Rock to Recovery. Stay with us. Stay close. We'll be back in a minute here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and I'm David, and Nate, this was a really, really fun conversation to have, because as a musician, to hear how somebody of Phil's professional caliber is willing to take himself out of the spotlight and into a place where he knows the value of the creative brain and what it can do to help, perpetuate the pharmacy in our heads, as he said, that produces the chemicals that creativity does and enhances our recovery.
I love Phil's story, and to me, it's a reminder of the fact that God doesn't waste anything.
Yeah,
all of his experience, all those thousands of songwriting sessions, he now brings that experience to what he does here in his work.
Right.
The experience he got working with Jelly Roll on the hip hop stage.
Yeah.
And now, at the right time, at this point in his recovery, now, really, it is all about service.
It is, and Rock to Recovery is a part of a lot of the Grammy Association's...
MusiCares.
MusiCares. And what they help fund and give them some exposure and referrals and things like that.
And from what I understand, Rock to Recovery, they do a lot of nonprofit work, but they fund it themselves.
Correct.
With a big show they do once a year out in L.A.
Right.
With A-list celebrities, big red carpet deal. We are waiting to find out. It hasn't yet been announced the exact date and the venue of where it'll be, but it's going to be big, and it's going to be in August, and it'll be in L.A.
Right.
So I don't know whether I can arrange to be in L.A. in August. That'd be nice.
It'd be fun.
Yeah.
Well, and the cool thing, too, is that the celebrities actually host it.
Yeah.
And they bring in people from the treatment centers to actually walk the red carpet and experience it.
Oh, man.
You know, so that, I thought, was just to flip it and, taking service again to another level that we don't maybe think about.
Yeah. Well, this has been another enjoyable conversation. I'm so glad we're doing this every week, David.
Oh, man, I'm loving it.
And we do have other guests coming up.
We do.
Yep. And by the way, we would love to hear from you. You can write us at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
We ponied up for that mailbox, buddy.
That's right. Fill it up.
let us know what your reactions are, any suggestions you have, any comments, any pushback, any praise. We'd love to hear from you.
We absolutely would.
Well, until next week, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We are your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
What's the name of the band?
The Goodbye Tribe.
And what's the name of the song?
I'm Amazing.
Yeah, you are. Blue, 3, 2, 1.
Our mindset, my sight set on where I feel. I find me, myself, and I on my way. My own trails I be a blazing, cause I feel oh so amazing.
The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.